thank you for coming, Fiona, and please have a seat.
Thanks very much, Michael. It's a great pleasure to be here. I follow the website all the time. It's very, very useful, let's say, to my work. So, as you heard, my discipline is social policy, the study of welfare states. And over the years, my work has been concerned with, on one side, how the inequalities and the intersectionalities around class, gender, race and ethnicity, as well as disability, sexuality and age, how these are constituted through and by welfare states. But I've also been interested in the whole area of care. And by that I mean care as a practice, that is a practical and often intimate relationship of caring. Care is the focus of policy, as the focus of political mobilisation, but also care as an ethic, a moral disposition. And over the past decade, my research has brought these two areas together in looking at the development of migrant care work. And coming from the discipline I do, I'm also interested in the normative. I'm concerned with how social policies might deliver social justice. So what I want to do in the talk today is I want to very briefly and rather simplistically contextualise my own research on migrant care work in European welfare states in terms of the different approaches that the discipline of social policy has taken to the to related issues of race, ethnicity and migration. And then the second thing I want to do, which is the bulk of my lecture, is to illustrate the analysis that I have been using in relation to researching migration and care work, and to suggest what this adds, what insights this might bring, both to social policy and to the study of migration. And the third section of my talk is I want to propose some of the analytical and normative implications for global social justice that emerge from my discussion. So first of all then, there have been three, in terms of race migration and the discipline of social policy, there have been three general approaches for anybody who's in the discipline here. Forgive me for being very simple about this. For a long time really, until the 1980s, race and migration had little analytical purchase in the discipline of social policy. It kind of emerged in the same way that moral panics emerged. So it would emerge, say, in 1972 with East African Asian refugees coming over. There would be an analysis sort of come to the surface. And usually a lot of that work was about migration and the use of services, right? Either, and it was usually based on an economistic view of immigration, you know, which is good because immigrants don't use the welfare services that much, or it's bad because they do use the services, right? Or they kind of pose some sort of threat to the future of welfare services. And these arguments tended to see migration in terms, on the one hand, of the recently arrived, and also in terms of their representing simply units of labour. And this was kind of, the 60s and 70s, this was the kind of focus. Or elsewhere you did get race and migration introduced into social policy, it was either around crime and criminology, or it was around urban studies, right? So it was kind of in a pathological way. Now, from the end of the 70s, a critical approach and a critique of the neglect of these areas developed, and my work has been part of that, really. And this sort of analysis, this critical approach, linked institutionalised racism in welfare services to how this affected welfare users, both as users of services, but also as people who work within the welfare services. And this was very important to recognise these two aspects of both ethnic minorities and newly arrived migrants. And this has really been an ongoing critique, because there's something about the discipline which means from time to time, when new theories are introduced, it kind of reverts to type. And that's partly because it's a discipline that came out originally from Fabian ideas, and then a little bit later, influenced by Marxism, in which class inequalities and the struggle between capital and labour ruled the sorts of analysis that we've had. So, as I say, it tends to be the case that when new theories arise, then they require a good shaking down, you know, to look at really how they're dealing, not only with race, racism, migration, but also with gender and a whole load of other things as well. And one example of this is one very, very influential area of work, which was Essing Anderson's work on welfare regimes. And this really established the theoretical basis for cross-national social policy. But it did so in a way which completely privileged the relationship between class and the state, and introduced a little bit around gender, but not very much, and completely ignored any aspects of racialized structuration or migration or anything like this. And indeed, Espen Andersen, Norwegian, the dominant view within social policy has been very influenced by Nordic scholars. And for a long time, that view was that immigration undermined welfare state growth. It weakened working class power, and it undermined the homogeneity upon which the solidarity for welfare states depends. And it's only really relatively recently, over the past 5 to 10 years, that there's been a shift in Nordic scholars in the way they've approached and acknowledged migration. And you can see that recent shift, a very important cross-national comparison in Diane Sainsbury's book, Welfare States and Immigration Rights, that came out last year. Now, a third area, and this is also linked to the second, really, and again, part of my work is part of this, has been to link migration and welfare to part of a larger international order, to be influenced by ideas of globalisation and international political economy of welfare, where, say, the migration of health personnel from poorer to rich countries serves to intensify global inequalities. And the idea of global care chains and so on can be seen as part of this, although, of course, what they do is pay more attention to questions of gender. Also, I think part of this broader approach has been work on the history of welfare and the way in which imperialism has been linked to welfare states. And particularly my own analysis, which I wrote in the 80s, how that backcloth of how the empire was part of the backcloth of the post-war welfare state. I mean, I see that as the empire being directly linked, both practically and symbolically, to the decline of empire. The welfare state was Britain's civilizing mission brought home, and it replaced the collective ideal of the empire with that of a nationally cohesive welfare state. And it's a backcloth that explains how it was that the post-war welfare state recruited migrants to work in it, whilst also at the same time denying them entitlements to the very services to which they were contributing. So, you know, that whole area of work is very important as a historical backcloth, and I'll refer again to that later. There's been a recent intervention in this sort of area, a new book on colonialism and welfare, which is interesting because it looks at this the other way around. It looks, and that's by James Midgley and David Pearshow, it looks at the British Empire legacy in terms of the way that the British welfare state influenced welfare states in its in the Commonwealth and part of its colonies. So that's my kind of background, very brief account of some of the sorts of ways in which social policy has dealt with these issues over time. Let me now explain how my own analysis within this has developed. because my approach to migration comes from a concern to put questions not only of race and racism and migration, but also of gender, class, disability and so on, at the centre of an analysis of welfare states, as I mentioned at the beginning. Thus, what I developed, and in many ways this was a kind of early study on intersectionality, what I developed in a book that was published in 1989, which I'm now finally rewriting, was that welfare states exist in a dynamic relationship to three interconnected domains. And these are the domains of family, nation and work. And this is significantly different from the way in which most social policy talks about the family, the state and the market as the triangle within which you study social policy. But what I've tried to do here is introduce into that the question of nation and nationhood. So I see these three areas as, first of all, signifying the conditions, the organisation and social relations of, in relation to family, social reproduction, including caring and intimacy, in relation to nation, the nation state and the population, which of course includes migration in and out, and in terms of work, employment production and capital accumulation. And briefly, what I have argued is that within this we can use this to ask who is included and who is excluded from these domains, and how is the welfare state positioned in relation to these? How does social policy respond to any of the changes in these domains? So developing from the changes in these areas, family, nation, work, being very important to understand when we're looking at social policy, I want to now move on to some of the work that I've done around migration and care. Because the phenomenon of migration and care work, whereby increasing numbers of women migrate from poorer countries to care for the households, older people and children in richer countries, illustrates precisely the changing nature of work, of families and of nations, and the relationship of welfare states or welfare regimes to this, how welfare states shape and reshape these areas. So first of all, obviously there's the global increase in women's involvement in the labour market, and in developed welfare states this has been marked by a shift away from the male breadwinner model, which was the model around which most welfare states as they developed were part, towards a new normative ideal, and it is only an ideal, the adult worker model, which assumes that all adults, men and women, will be in paid work. Now, in the poorer regions of the world, the destruction of local economies, unemployment and poverty have pressed women into assuming a greater breadwinning role as well, but with little state support, or in the case of Eastern Europe, with the retrenchment of the support that they used to have. Secondly, care has become what's called a new social risk. In the richer regions, the care deficit or the care crisis has been intensified by women's employment in the context of structural ageing, and concerns about declining fertility and, of course, social expenditure cuts. But these issues are no less pressing in developing countries, where, at its extreme, because different countries experience this in different ways, in Africa, AIDS, chronic illness, natural disasters, a high child dependency ratio put enormous burdens on women who are expected to care and to earn, but with little infrastructural support. And in the countries from which migrant workers originate, that lack of infrastructure intensifies both the rationale for migration and the caring responsibilities of those left behind. So this whole care crisis is particularly significant. And third, of course, there have been the changing patterns of post-colonial migration, which have included women also moving to seek earning opportunities, and all the issues associated with that, citizenship rights, the exploitation of unregulated labour, And as you know, many women find work in care and domestic work for which they're generally overqualified. In the EU, for example, they're more than twice as likely to be overqualified for the work that they do as their native-born counterparts. And of course, many enter a situation which has seen simultaneously the opening up and dependence of national economies on migrant labour and a political closure of nationalist and anti-immigration sentiment. Now, much of the earlier work on what has been called global care chains by people like Russell Perenius, Ali Hochschild and others focused on bringing together a relationship between the micro level and the macro level of this dynamic of migration and female migration. And what I mean by that is a relationship between the micro level, which studies the day-to-day relationships of care workers with their employers and or the people for whom they care, usually understanding this as being a relationship which is constituted by complex forms of power, not just ethnicity, gender and nationality, but also migrant status, class, age, able-bodiedness, all of these things, the complexity of a complex situation at the micro level. And usually they've related that to the macro level, to those processes which Russell Perenius called the international division of reproductive labour. In other words, the global context of inequalities in which care and migration take place and the way in which care resources are transferred from one country to another. Now, less developed in these studies, which sought to make this connection, is what helped shape dynamics at the meso level, right? And in Perenius's work, she refers to this level in terms of the transnational institutions, the sorts of networks which migrant workers are part of, that they create. And I think it's at this level where the new body of work, some of which is focused on welfare states, on home-based care and domestic work that's come out of a lot of European studies, where, of course, where state social policy is generally more developed than the United States, has posed new issues about the connections between the changing landscape of state social policies and the practices the kind of flows and regimes of migration. So it's this relationship between state policies, how they're changing, and migration that has been at the centre of developing this meso level. And this, in a way, is where social policy, you begin to see, has contributed to the study of migration and vice versa. Behind the increases in migrant care workers in Europe has been, if we look at it in policy terms, has been a new convergence around care policies, which began really at the beginning of this century in the EU, but also as part of the sorts of policies that were being pushed by international organisations such as the World Bank and the OECD. And these are generally referred to as social investment policies. And part of the kind of neoliberal trend within welfare states, but also representing a tempering of neoliberalism as well, because they have focused on welfare states as investing in the human capital of all adults as part of a strategy to enhance the potential of the labour market in order to develop people as more self-sufficient, in order to develop greater economic competitiveness, and also to kind of push greater social inclusion as well. So that mantra, make work pay, is what comes up in most European welfare states now. It's part of most of them. And it also signifies this move from the old breadwinner model of family life to a new two-earner model. And what this has led to is First of all, tying employment benefits more closely to labour market activation, and establishing for the first time in many places work-life balance policies such as maternity leave, paternity leave, childcare provision, in order to encourage women's employability. However, these have always also been part of a welfare modernisation agenda, which is aimed at cost effectiveness, especially in the light of political concerns about costs, the costs associated with an ageing society, with declining fertility, and of course now austerity. So welfare modernisation has been the kind of way in which these policies have been developed. And part of that has been this emphasis on a partnership between the state, the market and the voluntary sectors in the delivery of services in order to develop and respond to consumer choice. So what we've seen is these developments across Europe and also in other places, in Korea and Japan, for example. And these are care policies which, on the one hand, seem to represent greater recognition for public responsibility in meeting women's, working women's care responsibilities and meeting particularly older people's care needs. But at the same time, whilst there's been this recognition of care needs and responsibilities, at the same time, whether it's been in liberal or social democratic welfare states, what's become more common is the commodification of care and the influence of markets and market mechanisms as part of this partnership to meet care needs. So whereas in the United States, it's been the lack of public provision which shapes the employment of migrant workers, in Europe and part of Asia, it's been the very way in which care policies in particular have developed which has shaped the relationship between migration and care work. So there have been three key elements that have been important. First of all, the move from providing care services to giving individuals cash payments to help them buy in care. The UK, Spain, Finland, France, they've all introduced some form of cash provision or tax credit to assist buying in childcare or help in the home. And then there are forms of allowances, direct payments, which allow older or disabled people or their family carers to buy in assistance, and that's happened in the UK, Netherlands, Germany, Italy, Austria. Secondly, and crucially, there's been increasing reliance of the state on the voluntary, but especially the for-profit private sectors to deliver care services. And this has encouraged a particular form of home-based, often low-paid, commodified care or domestic help. In other words, although some support for care comes from the state, it's often in the private market where people will find their care services and their care providers. So this has had the effect of turning care into a commodity and service users into consumers. They're searching for good value for money in a marketplace of care services. So just as an example, this was somebody who we interviewed in an earlier study. This is about 5 or 6 years ago, a bit longer, 8 years ago. An au pair was what we could afford. This is a working mother in London. Au pair was what we could afford. We had a spare room because nannies are incredibly expensive if you pay them properly. She was, you know, looking through this market of care provision. The third area has been contracting out domiciliary services, nurseries or residential homes to the private sector. And that has meant a worsening of pay conditions and led to labour shortages. So where care has historically been undervalued and underpaid, it's performed by those with least negotiating power. And this is where migrant labourers have stepped into the situation. Now, these developments, I'm describing them as though they've happened in the same way, but they haven't. I mean, what's interesting about this, I'm going on to, this is what I want to talk about now, is how we begin to analyse the fact that this has happened differently in different welfare states, given that welfare states in different countries are themselves historically different. On the one hand, we can see some converging trends. I mean, you'll be familiar with this stuff, so I'll go over it quite quickly. Particularly in the increases in the employment of migrant workers in care. So in Spain, for example, over 62% of those employed in domestic caring activity in the household are migrant workers, and that's been a fourfold increase in 10 years. In Italy, in 2006, over 70% of home-based care workers were migrants, and that was a threefold increase in 4 years. And these figures refer to registered workers, but there are many who aren't, or who are undocumented or waiting to receive papers, where you can't get numbers. In the UK, the British Au Pairs Agencies Association was reported as estimating that whilst the official numbers of au pairs in 2012 was 12,000, they reckoned, and this is just personal communication and not to be cited really, but they reckoned that there were around 100,000 au pairs, and they reckoned about 80% of these came from Eastern Europe and the UK. In addition, both Japan and Korea have initiated the recruitment of co-ethnic foreigners as care workers, and in Korea, these increased 3.5 times between 2007 and 2010, 334,000. Now, as an aside, I should say, I've talked about these increases. It's not clear yet what the effect of the recession and austerity is having on these sorts of numbers. I've read Chris Tilley's work, and he says that you can see a sharp dip in migration, particularly when you look at the extremes of the richer and poorer countries, migration between them. But he also says that this isn't even across the sectors, because elder care, healthcare, domestic work are less susceptible to the fluctuations that hit, say, the construction industry. I mean, maybe there are people here who have more knowledge, but also it will depend, I suppose, on what happens to professional women's employment as well. Nevertheless, in spite of some of these converging trends, similar developments, this hasn't been the same across Europe, and that's what I want to talk about for now. I've called this a situation of converging variations. So, for example, whilst in Spain and Italy, migrant workers are employed by families to look after frail older people in their homes, and they're actually supported by state allowances to do so. In the UK, when it comes to elder care, then migrant workers are much more likely to be employed by private sector residential and home care services. So on the one hand, what seems similar is actually in practice rather different. And that signifies different historical legacies in the balance between the state, the market, the voluntary sector, and family provision, and also different cultures of care. Spain and Italy have familialist traditions in both child and elder care, whereas the UK has a tradition of public provision for elder care, but really until very recently, childcare was seen to be the responsibility of the family, until very recently. Similarly, whilst there's a growing convergence in the use of markets and market mechanisms, the actual type of mechanisms, whether you're talking about contracting out or financial budgets or tax credits or cash payments, they've been very different in different countries. So although you have similar movements, you've got different ways in which these are happening. And there's another diversity in the employment and migrant statuses that care workers have. They might be part of professional occupational quotas in one country, or specified and temporary work permits, they might be on student visas, they might be refugees, and so on and so forth. So there are different ways in which this manifests itself. And that's what I was just talking about. Now, developing from empirical research I did with Anna Gavanis on home-based childcare in Madrid, Stockholm and London, I've suggested that a way to understand these similarities and differences in different welfare states is to look at the way in which care regimes, that's care policies and provision, especially care markets, care cultures, especially familialism, how these intersect with migration regimes, rules, regulations and practices concerning migrants and racialized others, and also with employment regimes, the gendered and racialized divisions in the labor market, for example. And what I have argued is that it's in the intersection of the way in which these three different regimes operate that we can understand and identify the institutional context which shapes the experience at the micro level, the day-to-day experiences between migrant care workers and the people that they're working for, as well as the variations and convergences in different countries of migrant care work. So that's what I've been trying to grapple with, and that's the framework that I've used. So this, I think, offers a number of insights, right? First of all, it draws attention to the multifaceted nature of the state and how regimes unintentionally intersect to produce different outcomes for the migrant care work relationship. The second insight is to draw attention to the relationship between policy and culture, right? Not just between society and culture, but actually policy and culture. So it elaborates what it is at the meso level, which connects to global macro dynamics on the one hand, and the micro detail of experience or practice on the other. So in the example that I just mentioned about Spain and Italy and UK elder care, it shows that there are some of the cultural and sectoral differences between care practices in those countries. And it also shows the way in which there are differences in migration. So, for example, as far as migration is concerned, Spain and Italy have a combination of domestic worker quotas and amnesties for irregular migrants, whereas UK migration policies have been increasingly restricted to those defined as less skilled, and much care work is defined as less or unskilled. So those create differences, but in spite of those differences, we find similarities in the recent increases in migrant care work, and also similarities in the way in which those migrant care workers are treated or the experience of them. So, it's similar in terms of long hours, low salary, restricted choices in employment situations. To draw another example from about this relationship between culture, which isn't just about family, but it's about nation and nationalism and ethnicity as well. Japan and Korea are very interesting because in some ways their migration regimes have been similar to the UK in being quite restrictive. But there are also differences which relate to national culture. In Korea's case, immigration for care work is restricted to Korean co-ethnicity. In other words, you have to be a Korean ethnic but from another country in order to have a basis for eligibility. This is mainly people from Russia and China. And this fits with the ideal of the Korean nation as ethnically homogeneous. In Japan, what's happened there is that, in common with many countries, that the informal recruitment into care work has drawn on existing permanently settled foreigners. And these have often been Filipina women who came into the country as entertainers and then married a Japanese person. And also foreign wives married to Koreans are also another source of care workers in Korea. And what's interesting is that this way marriage has become a route for female migrants to go into both what we might see as paid and unpaid care work. But also ethnic nationalism in Japan has had some unnerving consequences. There was a survey that showed that in the context of one of the sharpest ageing profiles in the world, older Japanese people prefer to be looked after by humanoid robots rather than foreign care workers. And this is part of the government's sort of plan looking forward to 2020, that they have developed these ideas. And such a preference over foreign care workers for robots not only suits this sort of dogged, racist, but mythical idea of a Japanese ethnic homogeneity, but it also fits with, read this in an anthropological article, it also fits with dominant spiritual beliefs in animism, where there's less dualism than in the West between living subjects and non-living objects. So in those terms, it's more compatible to think of a non-living object as a care worker than it might be to our sort of sensibility. A third insight to be drawn from this approach is that it's not only countries with liberal or minimal or familialist welfare states that have had this increasing use of migrant care workers. It's actually been, it's cut across most sorts of welfare regimes. And perhaps the most surprising area in which there's been an increase is in the Nordic countries, because they've been held up to be the paragon of women-friendly welfare states. And I'm just going to talk a little bit about this because I think it's very interesting. To begin with, in the Nordic countries, there has been a much greater commodification of domestic work. In 2007, Sweden introduced tax breaks for people employing domestic help in the home. But in doing that, they were following Denmark, Norway and Finland, who had introduced this sort of policy. And interestingly, it was introduced in terms of both gender equality, or at least equality for professional families, and also to try and regularise the grey market in domestic work. Although a couple of people who've done research in this area in Sweden have said that the effect has actually been to legitimise, in a similar fashion to other countries, to legitimise the commodification of household work and actually to create new employers, older people, middle class families with young children, who are now making use of this tax break. And in fact, seeking these sorts of individualistic solutions to work-life balance has become surprisingly common for professional women in many of the Nordic countries. So, for example, in Norway, between 2000 and 2008, the number of au pairs increased tenfold. And what's interesting is that by 2008, 72% of these were Filipinas. And that denoted a shift away from a kind of what used to be a system of cultural exchange to one of care and domestic work. And you can see a similar increase and pattern in Denmark as well. Recently, the Social Democratic Mayor of Copenhagen wrote in his council's recruitment magazine that he said modern executive women need not be faced with the dilemma of family and career. In special cases, he wrote, the local council can even offer a subsidy for au pair and cleaning services as part of the salary package. So that whole idea that this is what a professional woman might be entitled to has become very much part of life. In addition, you find increasing numbers of foreign-born workers, although I have to say in Sweden many of these are permanent residents, are found in the lower grades of home-based care, domestic work, hotel work and health care. But this is also combined with more contracting out. Right? Contracting out in elder care has combined with existing racialisation in the labour market, and therefore migrant groups have been channelled into less attractive areas of care work. So in Stockholm, 39% of assistant nurses and 46% of personal assistants and care aides are foreign born. And similar for Oslo, 40% of employees in the nursing and care center sector were foreign born in 2008. But this leads on to another aspect of all of this, which is, and this is the fourth sort of point that I want to make here, is that it leads us into a broader conception of what it is that constitutes migrant care labour, because what is happening is that states are becoming global employers. The pressure to reduce state health and social care provision results not only in private employers, but also in states recruiting cheaper in health and care labour from poorer regions. So what we can see, what I think the kind of social policy perspective gives us, is a kind of continuum from your domestic worker working in the household across through to social care and healthcare migrant worker employment, particularly in nursing. Now, Nicola Yates has called the healthcare and nursing migrant worker employment, she's called these global nursing care chains. And she also sees this as part of the new international division of reproductive labour. We can see this in Britain, UK, in Sweden and Norway. They have the highest, they had the highest percentages of migrant workers in health and community services. And again, what's interesting about that is that whereas those are workers that used to come from kind of mid-range countries, you know, in terms of prosperity, they're now much more likely to come from Poland, Latvia and the Philippines. So, as I say, states are becoming global employers, working alongside and often with private recruitment agencies. And the workers they employ, again, share common experiences with the migrant home base and private sector care workers. Gender and race discrimination at work, lack of recognition of skills and qualifications, being concentrated in the least desirable specialisms. They may pay national insurance and taxes, but not be eligible for benefits, whilst also missing out on contributions in their countries of origin. So, to summarise this second part, I want to make 4 points again, I think it is, right. So first of all, I won't go into this because I need to move on, but first of all, these convergences undermine the traditional distinctions of welfare regimes, and this is where looking at migration really adds to the way in which social policy has been working in the past, with its clear distinctions between liberal, social, democratic and conservative welfare regimes. And I think the most striking area is in marketisation, the marketisation of care services and the link between that and migration. The second point is the fact that whilst I've identified marketisation as having a crucial role to play, there's also this bigger question of the unfinished business of equality between men and women in relation to issues of work-life balance. And as part of this, the low priority that's being put on the value of care, especially at times of retrenchment of services. And this is not only an issue for developed countries, but an issue for developing countries as well. Thirdly, both of these dynamics operate within a context of geopolitical inequalities between richer and poorer nations that have been superimposed on historical precedents. So what's very interesting, I mentioned this right at the beginning, what's very interesting is that in the 50s and 60s in Britain, the recruitment of health and care labour came from the colonies and provided cheap labour for the new institutions of the welfare state, and met a labour shortage which would otherwise have had to be filled by married women. That was the ideal of the male breadwinner. The ideal now is of the adult worker model. And what we can see is that the use of migrant domestic and care labour prevents the disruption of the new adult worker model, because it's a way of allowing women to continue to work. And then and today, these are cost-effective ways of securing family norms and also meeting care needs, even though those norms have changed. Fourth, and importantly, as I've been arguing, whilst there are variations across Europe in all of these things, there's also this converging trend towards employment of migrant workers in different types of care regime, sector and site. But this is dependent on the positioning of that welfare regime within the global market for care and health labour. So insofar as there's a convergence, then it's towards reinforcing these geopolitical inequalities. In other words, there are divergent processes moving towards a common trajectory, and that trajectory follows a transnational political economy of care in which European and other developed countries' welfare states reduce, directly or indirectly, their increasing social expenditure costs through strategies which involve migrant health and care labour. What I now want to do in my last 10 minutes is I want to just outline what I mean by the transnational political economy of care, which is a term that I use. I mean, there are different terms that different people use here. And then suggest that by looking at it in these terms, we can begin to think about the question of global social justice in this area. So, I've suggested that there are five aspects that we might look at in this transnational political economy of care. The first is what I've been describing, this movement of social reproductive labour. The second is the dynamics, or the transnational dynamics of care commitments. As part of this, people leave behind younger or older people to be cared for. And what's important to highlight here is that the care crisis that this creates in the poorer regions of the world far more than outweighs the care crisis in the richer countries, even though their effects are rather similar, their effects are similar. Thirdly, there's this whole transnational movement of care capital. Social care and healthcare, the private market in these areas, are big international business now. Bupa, for example, has operations in Spain, Ireland, Thailand, Hong Kong and Saudi Arabia. And the principles of market investment, risk, expansion, profit, conflict with the principles of care provision, which are about individual needs, continuity, quality of services. The fourth and the fifth dimensions refer to political actors. On the one hand, I already described how you have the transnational influence of discourses around care and care policies. And I've talked about the social investment discourse, which has underpinned a lot of programmes, not only in the developed world, but in the developing countries as well. And then on the other side, you have transnational activity of social movements, of non-governmental and grassroots organisations. And groups such as these pressured the International Labour Organization during 2010 to agree to consider adopting an international convention for the protection of the rights of domestic workers. So in terms of the strategies that this sort of analysis and this way of thinking might develop, I think we need to think about strategies in three ways. First of all, temporarily. There are temporary strategies, both for the immediate and for the immediate longer term. We need to think about strategies geopolitically, both in terms of countries of origin of migrants as well as countries of destination. And we need to think about the different levels at which strategy can be put pressure on it, the national level, on bilateral relationships, international and global social policy. So in terms of, these are just examples, in terms of immediate strategies in countries of destination, countries of origin, for example, there are all these things: regularisation of domestic and care work, rights to citizenship, rights to family reunion, contracts, social protection and so on, coordination across these different areas, care, migration, employment, ethical recruitment codes which exist in healthcare, and all depend very much on, you know, groups having a voice and having some influence, and, you know, pressure to be put on the global NGOs. In countries of origin, Jane Pillinger has done some very good action research which emphasises that the decision to migrate should be one of informed choice rather than pressured by lack of financial and professional improvements. She talks about coordinated strategies for ethical emigration policies worked out through social dialogue in the countries of origin. But of course, all of this depends on the health and care infrastructure, on improving that in countries of origin. And again, fundamental to that is the democratic process of people having a voice to make those sorts of demands. But in terms of longer term strategies, I've been thinking about this in two different ways recently. I've been wondering whether the WHO developed a global code of practice for health care in 2010, and whether it's possible to apply that to care work, right? Basically, what the global code of practice did for healthcare, and probably people who know a lot more about this than I do, is that from the sorts of bilateral agreements that have been developed in particular between particular countries to bilateral ethical recruitment codes that prevented poaching health workers from poorer countries and provided guarantees for free training and support for returning doctors and nurses. In developing that, what became the priority was measures to counter global inequalities in healthcare. And this seems to me to be very important. You know, how do we develop strategies which prioritise the inequalities in care resources, the sorts of care crises that are occurring both in countries of origin and countries of destination? But also, what's interesting about the global code of practice, I think it's interesting for its limitations as well, what we can learn from its limitations. You know, sometimes these sorts of policies serve to kind of marginalise workers even more. But it also built on a human rights approach, you know, rights to healthcare, rights to migration and so on. And I wonder whether you can apply these two dimensions, human rights and also global inequalities in care resources, towards strategies to be argued for at the international global level. And I've got two experiences of the possibility of connecting care to human rights. The first is that I worked with the European Social Platform over a period of 2 years, just sort of advising. The European Social Platform is made up of organisations, grassroots organisations across Europe, in all sorts of areas, migrants' rights, you know, childcare, all sorts of areas to do with social rights. And they developed a manifesto to present to the European Commission, which they did about 18 months ago, on the development of care policy in Europe, in the EU. And what was fundamental to this, what was at the core of their proposals, which actually extended towards migrant care workers very integrally, was a fundamental right to provide and receive care. And I thought that that conception of a fundamental right to provide and receive care was absolutely crucial to the way we think about this. Because, you know, it goes further than a right to a family life, because it's much more inclusive than a right to a family life, which can be quite sort of heteronormative in its implications, right, and quite ethnocentric. It's much more in line with Martha Nussbaum's ideas of the capabilities approach of, she talks about the capabilities of emotions and affiliations. But also recently, I received an invitation from Magdalena Sepulveda, and she is the new special rapporteur in the UN on poverty and human rights. She's been given this brief. And I received an invitation to a meeting in Geneva, an expert meeting, where what she's called a meeting on unpaid care, women's poverty and human rights. And in my knowledge, this is the first time that these three things have been put together. And that is to draw up recommendations to go to the Assembly of the UN in October. And I just have this feeling that this might be the way to go with strategies, to bring care into a human rights, care and human rights together. But having said that, I still think, I would still push for what I call a care ethical approach to social justice. And what I mean by this is that the big and the long-term issues that are raised by migration and care are the limited advances of gender equality, both in countries of origin and destination, geopolitical inequalities, and the marketization of care provision. And really none of these issues can be dealt with unless policymakers recognise the centrality of care to everyday life. We need this because care now, the crisis of care, is as significant, as Nancy Fraser has argued, is as significant as the global financial crisis or the global environmental crisis. This crisis is very important. But the way policymaking develops is to focus on economic competitiveness, on the ethic of paid work, on the facilitation of markets, and now increasingly on austerity. The principle of paid work has been central to reforms everywhere, getting people off welfare and into work. And where care policies have been developed, their rationale has often been about getting women into work. So I think it's important to begin to turn this around by arguing for the social, the economic and political value of care, which is worthy of another lecture. But really, to summarise all of this, what I see, and to conclude, what I see at the heart of the dynamics between migration and care work are two intersecting processes. On the one side is the devaluation and invisibility of care activity and its subservience to the public world of work and markets. And on the other is this asymmetric draining of care resources from some regions to save the care costs of others. And as this is happening, care is becoming increasingly once more invisible and out of mind. So I'm arguing that care is central to the global economy, its inequalities and its crisis, and therefore we need to see care as a collective social good and central to notions of global justice, as central as it is to everyday life.